Hey, listeners. Welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. This is a special episode for us. We are 21 episodes in, and in the podcasting world, that means we joined the elusive 1% that didn't quit. This week, we celebrate the launch of the Elections Best Practices Deck, spearheaded by Glenn and Katie. So we asked Glenn and Katie to join the show. Yes, this is the Katie Harbath, our inaugural guest and founder and CEO of Anchor Change. Before that, she worked at Meta for 10 years, where she built and led a 30-person team managing elections. Glenn Ellingson joins the show for the first time. Glenn managed civic integrity teams at Facebook and Instagram. He brings his engineering leader expertise to show us how to implement these best practices. Here are some of the questions we answer on today's episode. How to prioritize different elections across the world. What principles to adhere to when working on election integrity? What are the challenges of dealing with political harassment? How to map out the landscape of election integrity work. What was Cambridge Analytica? And did the scandal actually make platforms less transparent? And how your company can learn best practices and responsibly deal with elections. As a reminder, the views stated in this episode are not affiliated with any organization and only represent the views of the individuals. We hope you enjoy the show. Katie, Glenn, welcome. You guys just had a big release. Can you tell me more about this release?
Sure. I'll start and then I'll let Glenn take it from there. So yes, on Wednesday, May 17th, we launched our Elections Best Practices Deck Part 1. Of how many parts, we don't quite know yet, but this all started. One of the first donations that the Integrity Institute got was from the Knight Foundation to do work on election integrity issues and stuff through 2024. And so one of the first things that we wanted to do was start to help to pull together, like, what exactly needs to go into building an election integrity program? What are all the different aspects you have to think about? How do you even get started? Some of the history around all of this. And particularly once a lot of the layoffs started happening last fall, we had a lot of people that worked not just inside Meta, but Twitter and other companies that have done a lot of this work that were now free agents to be able to really talk about this. And we also have a lot of newer platforms that are struggling with a lot of this for the first time. And so I'll let Glenn kind of talk about a bit about the member process that we went through for this. But we realized we had to break it up into parts because there's so much content here that it would have been incredibly overwhelming, but it was really exciting to see all the members kind of come together and pull together this information. Glenn, I don't know if you want to kind of go through what the member process was and sort of how that worked.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really been rewarding to sort of pull people together and talk about all this stuff. I mean, as integrity professionals, all of us in the Institute, right? Like, kind of this is our day job. This is what we do. And especially for those of us who are working in the elections cycles in particular, like, we went through the big planning cycle for 2022 and, you know, in the US and other things, and there's sort of a season there in several countries. And as those were wrapping up, we were like, all right, we've done it again. We've learned a bunch of stuff. And it's like, how do we actually share some of the things that we learned? So we kind of decided as we were wrapping to be taking notes. And the Institute also did some great stuff which I think we've mentioned on this podcast before, where we brought some people together during some of these elections, things to share sort of questions and answers and support through the process of some of these elections. But we said, like, how do we share this more widely with the integrity community? Because I think we really feel that elections are kind of a stress test for your integrity processes. So we just put the word out within the integrity group. Interested parties came together. We collected a bunch of experiences and learnings, figured out how to organize them, how to make them useful, brought in stakeholders who hadn't been through an elections process as well for some feedback on whether this was landing for folks, and went to some outside folks as well and got some feedback. And in the end, as Katie said, we decided we wanted to say a lot of stuff. So what we're doing this month is saying some of that stuff, really concentrating on sort of how and why this is such an important thing, and how you might get started in it if you are, let's say, facing one or many elections that your users of your platform, let's say, are going to be dealing with in the upcoming year, how you might start wrestling with that.
For sure. Just to get started, let's talk about both of you first. So Katie, you were at Facebook from February 2011 to March 2021. So for 10 years, you saw Facebook grow a lot, I guess. I don't even know the amount of employees that were there in February 2011.
A little over 3,000. 3,500 sounds about right of what it was employee-wise in 2011.
Oh, 10X basically when you were there.
Yeah.
Oh, nice, nice. And then Glenn, you were there from May 2019 through June 2022. So you guys intersected for around, let's say, 2 years. How did you two, Katie as a policy person and Glenn as an engineering leader, work together to, one, understand what elections programs look like and to try to mitigate the harms?
Well, in all honesty, I'm not sure how much Glenn and I directly work together on a lot of these issues. You know, so my team, even though I was on the public policy team, I was managing the team that was coordinating the company's election work across all these different teams at the company. And so by 2019, in May of 2019, when Glenn arrived, which had been right smack dab in the middle of all sorts of elections in India, Indonesia would have just ended, European Parliament would have been happening right then and there. And so we had, at that point in time, we had about 40 plus teams and 500 full-time employees and about 30,000 contractors and stuff that was working on all of these elections. And so we were trying to make sure everybody knew what everybody else was doing. We were trying to coordinate that. And that could be everything from how do we handle escalations when different issues are coming in, longer term, trying to think about the research that we might be doing, the types of products we might need to build, the interventions that are happening. I oftentimes was sort of the default person when they were like, we should have somebody from policy okay this. Let's ask Katie to figure out who that person should be in terms of thinking about this. So this was, at least at Facebook, a very large enterprise. I think for each of those elections in May of 2019, we had at least 300 full-time people on each one, because we had to split it up because there were so many big ones happening that we were kind of had two teams that had to leapfrog one another. And so that's where I was spending a lot of my time.
Yeah, that's just utterly fascinating, because I did come in 2019 and I came into this what felt like such a big, well-oiled and fantastic group of people that were assembled doing all this terrific work. And, you know, my background before that, I'd worked in some global internet platforms, but most immediately before Meta, I was doubling down on some political tools in the US. I came to Meta because of the global reach and then got slapped in it in the face right as soon as I walked in the door, because as Katie put it, I walked it in and people were like, hey, here's all this fantastic stuff we've just done for the Indian elections, and we're doing Indonesia and we're doing EU. And I was like, wow. I was so grateful to have a well-formed team around me to help make that possible and to educate me on some of this stuff. So I feel like I was a beneficiary of some good planning and set up of some elections work, which is why I like to try and help give back this way. I was there for only 3 years. It was three really interesting years, right? Had the benefit of working on these big, deep teams at one of the largest and most funded internet platforms in the world. But, you know, walked into the U.S. 2020 election, as well as things going on in several other countries that were hugely impactful, all taking place in the middle of the COVID election. So my 3 years were this whirlwind of elections, COVID, elections during COVID, and then really all the structural things that go on about the tough trade-offs that you have with misinformation online, digital literacy and how it differs, and election context and how deep you can get in that around the globe, and all of those balances between entertainment, freedom, and safety. And I think, you know, Katie and her teams in policy were really trying to help us guide, how do you approach this at a high level? What are the right things for the company to be doing and not? And I'm a technologist. So I was supporting some teams that were actually building things to try and implement and make real those policies and hit those policy goals. So it was really interesting to be in the middle of those bills.
So first of all, thanks for the detailed responses from both of you. Glenn, you mentioned a couple of things that I really want to bounce off of. One is the U.S. versus the rest of the world. Two is the COVID elections versus quote-unquote normal elections. And Katie, I know you were there for the Cambridge Analytica scandal too. And you both mentioned trade-offs that were made between free speech, digital literacy, and balancing the misinformation campaigns. I wanted to hone in a bit on what has gone wrong in the past and maybe what Katie saw in 2016 and how that resulted in the well-oiled machine that Glenn joined in 2019. Was there a postmortem? And what did you guys do in terms of organization to address the gaps you noticed? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so I won't bore people with the full history of everything around Facebook and elections. They can go look at I did an explainer of a brief history of tech and elections going back to 96. So if people want to go way back, they can.
Where is that explainer?
Going back, it's on the bipartisan policy side, and maybe we can just put it in the show notes so that people can link to it. But so 2016, May 9th, 2016 is a huge date in the history of all this that many people, if you're sitting here listening, think back if you can think about what happened on May 9th, 2016. What happened on that date were two things. One, it was the day of the Philippines election when Rodrigo Duterte came to power. It was also the day that a controversy broke around trending topics at Meta, where a contractor accused the company of suppressing conservative content in a unit they had back then, which was like Trending Now. It was very similar, like Twitter's Trending Now stuff. And so that actually, in hindsight, kicked off a lot of questions around what was happening on the platform, not just around elections, but politics overall. There had always been sort of this undercurrent from conservatives, kind of skeptical of Silicon Valley. This sort of broke it out open into the forefront. A month later, you had Brexit. And then everybody, that being a shocking election and people wondering how in the world did the Leave campaign win? And they had been using digital tools and stuff like that. And then throughout the rest of 2016, there were glimmers. If you look back of the beginnings of this, there were questions around the role of foreign interference and in Russians. And now we know that the Obama administration and others had some signals that they weren't necessarily sharing. There were obviously stuff happening on the platforms with ads being run and stuff like that we missed. I also remember, too, The Economist in September of 2016 had a cover story called Post-Truth Politics. So they're already talking about the things that Donald Trump was saying and how those might be combated, et cetera. But everyone still thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. That was still the conventional wisdom amongst a lot of people. And plus, I remember having some conversations inside the company about, like, because I was really worried. I'm like, oh man, this is going to be so hard for us to figure out. There were elections in 2017 early on in France and Germany. And I was like, this is going to be a challenge to think about how we combat this. And when I would go and talk to some of the product folks, they're like, how are we even going to determine what's true or false? Like, how do we even want to be putting ourselves in that position? And after Trump won, it was just, it felt like overnight, even though it really wasn't overnight, but it felt like overnight. It went from like anything tech companies could touch turned to gold to everything we could touch turned to dust. And all of the attention was centered really on digital tools and Facebook in particular, because the Trump campaign was saying how they thought Facebook was one of the key tools that they had used to help them win their election. There was Mark doing the comment like a week or two later about how it was crazy that Facebook could have impacted the election. I think there's still, the jury's still out and how much, you know, it wasn't just Facebook that did this. But now all of a sudden we're scrambling to try to figure out, okay, first it was the fact checking stuff. So we went from the September of people being like, I have no idea how we're going to do this, to December. They have the first version of these tools out where we're working with fact checkers and labeling that type of content. And it wasn't just political stuff. Actually, early on, it was a lot of stuff too. Like, this celebrity died in your hometown. Can you believe it? There's a lot of clickbaity stuff. I think it's also important for people to remember that the first stories coming out of 2016 was not Russian interference. It was Macedonian teenagers who were pushing fake news to make money. And so that was the first round of things that people were trying to pay attention to and starting to build. Then the first half of 2015 was, I don't want to say quiet, but it was quieter than what was about to come. It was sort of, we were in the eye of the hurricane in some ways, because in April, Facebook put out a report talking about foreign interference in the election, but they didn't directly mention Russia. Congress was starting to dig into all this stuff a bit more. And then in the fall of 2017, it was early September, Facebook announces that they found the Russian Internet Research Agency ads on the platform. And that's when we started building out the political and issue ad transparency tools. That was when we had the first, it was at the time, it was the legal counsel. So Colin Stretch for Facebook and some of the other platforms had their first congressional hearing on all of this around Halloween of 2017. And then you fast forward to March of 2018, and that's when the Cambridge Analytica scandal broke. So we were basically inside the company. It was one wave after the other. And on top of all of that, you had in 2018, we knew we had the Brazilian and US elections that were going to be happening that fall. And so we are trying to reshift what had been our civic empowerment team, kind of building election day reminders, voter registration reminders, stuff like that, shifting them to the integrity work, trying to figure out how we build some of these tools and systems for the first time to be ready for those elections while also dealing with all of these different controversies that are hitting us and trying to figure out like how in the world do you prioritize trying to get some of this work done? What does that need to look like, et cetera? And so that was a really busy time of just starting to get a lot of this work up off the ground.
So what was Cambridge Analytica from your perspective on the inside?
Yeah. So Cambridge Analytica, the story was they were a political consulting firm based out of the United Kingdom that worked with both the Leave campaign. They had been signed by the Trump campaign, but they were not the only ones doing work with the Trump campaign. And they made a lot of pitches claiming that they had access to unique Facebook data that nobody else did, particularly the behavioral data that they were able to then model to better figure out how to persuade people to vote one way or the other. Now, this data that they talk about actually comes from a decision Facebook made back in 2010. So I think that's one lesson that's important for folks that are listening to this podcast right now is there might be decisions that you at the company are making right now that seem okay and actually seem like really positive things to do for your company, but that 8 years later might become a scandal in some way, shape, or form of thinking about, because Facebook was created in this thing called Open Graph. So if folks remember back in the day, you want to sign up to play Farmville, you want to find your friends who are playing Farmville, you hit connect with Facebook and it'll show your friends who are also playing Farmville. That seems innocent enough, right? That all came from when you clicked on that connect with Facebook button, you weren't just giving Facebook access to your data, you were also giving it access, or whatever that app was, you were also giving it access to your friends and like your friends' like email address and likes and interests. It wasn't all the data, but it was enough to help make connections. The Obama campaign, frankly, used this in 2012 to do something called targeted sharing to try to better help people connect with people they know or have something in common with versus complete strangers of trying to help people to vote for President Obama. What was also happening then was that a research scientist at Cambridge University was running a quiz where people would use Connect with Facebook and then they would take a person, I think it was like a personality quiz or something like that. And he was going to use that data for research, which was allowed under the Facebook terms and conditions back then. Well, he ends up selling that or giving that data to this Cambridge Analytica firm, which is against the terms and conditions. But we didn't realize this was happening until we started hearing from different other firms and people that they were pitching that they claimed to have this special data. And it wasn't until some whistleblowers, so it actually had been first reported like in late 2015, because they worked for Senator Cruz, but it wasn't until some whistleblowers came forward with actual documents and stuff that the really big scandal broke in 2018. Now, the challenge here is that there was definite absolute truth around the question around people's privacy and data and how that should be used and some decisions by the company early on about that, about the challenges of being able to track where that data goes after it's been taken off your platform. But then there was this, you know, people were desperate to figure out how in the world did Trump win? How in the world did Leave win? They were still trying to get their heads wrapped around it. And they're not digital experts. They don't know. They're just saying, okay, Cambridge Analytica claimed they could do all this modeling. And people really freaked out about it. The thing was, if you talk to anybody that used that data, it didn't work. It didn't work that well. It was really old data. The methodologies and stuff that they were using, like the Trump campaign themselves said that they did not use Cambridge Analytica's work a lot. But what that did do is it really helped to kind of start spurring regulation in Europe and other places, even though we don't have it yet in the US at the federal level. But I think it also did a lot of harms because Meta in particular, but other companies were really reluctant then to open any data up to researchers again, unless there were some sort of, you know, regulation or laws that would help to give them some cover that in case something like this happened again. And so, in fact, I did, maybe we can link this in the show notes as well, at Bipartisan Policy Center, we did a look back because it was the 5-year anniversary here in March at Cambridge Analytica. And we had one of the New York Times reporters that wrote on the story, as well as a gentleman named Alex Lundry, who does data analytics for political campaigns, and myself, talking a lot about this. But that sort of shows the challenges, because we were in no place for anybody to trust us or anybody else in terms of trying to change public perception. And so we had to deal with that, even though we may know that like the substance of the argument might not be as strong as what people thought it was going to be.
Thanks, Katie. So now, Glenn, you joined this well-oiled machine, but then this well-oiled machine basically collapses in March 2020. Or maybe it doesn't collapse.
Yeah, I don't know if it collapsed, but I mean, I called it a well-oiled machine because it really was remarkable how much the team had, well, managed to build itself in a reasonably small number of years, and the number of sort of well-structured things the team was doing. But I mean, to some extent, I think we're all still in today figuring out how social media and different platforms with different shapes really change how discussions work and really have expected and unexpected real world impacts, and how they get used in one context and then how they get used, you know, that same feature works differently in a different context. So we're still learning about these sorts of things. Like Cambridge Analytica was a great like example of that, right? Like nobody really cares, or they don't react with outrage anyway, if you have this information about your friends to match you up on Farmville, but they do sort of care if they see it as producing political polarization and sort of secret channels for sending out agendas that don't get reviewed and seen by people outside of bubbles, right? Like, so you know, how structurally the platforms work is an ongoing learning. And then, yeah, there's always new shocks from the outside world as well. So, you know, I was joining and shortly thereafter, we did have COVID, and that threw a whole new set of things around like how elections were changing on the fly, how everyone was living on the fly, how the team was working on the fly. We had this team doing this really important work on, you know, COVID, less specifically elections. We've been working together for a year, and we realized that of all the people on the team, so 10 people or so on this little team, and you take all the factorial of who's met who in person, and the answer was one pairing of two people had met each other in person ever, and nobody else in the team had even met anybody else, any of their coworkers, right? And that one meeting predated them actually being on the team together. So like, you know, how do you work in these changing environments that are affecting how your teams work, and how do you react to really changing global circumstances and changing and evolving understanding of how your platform is working and being viewed in the real world? Because yeah. I think Katie alluded to this a little bit, like when you're talking about elections and other sort of some of these more sensitive topics that integrity sort of lives in, it's not just a matter of what your platform may be causing in terms of real world harm to other people, although that does happen. There's real world harm from a lot of these things that we manage, but it's also the question of what are the harms that are there for your platform as you're in these situations, right? Like, do you have public perception risks? Do you have legal liability risks or compliance risks? Are you going to like, are you asking your teams to do the impossible? You're going to burn everybody out and have nobody to deal with these problems at all. So there's a lot to balance.
Yeah, I actually want to double click on that. You said, what are the problems and the risks associated to the company? So yeah, tell me, what are the election problems and what risks are associated with the company?
Katie's a real area as a policy person, and the person who got pulled into these conversations. I'm an implementer, so part of my job is not to screw things up and cause more nightmares for Katie and for PR staff in a platform. But realistically, even being one remove, like I was in the middle of building, but I'm in a company that's having these public relations moments. And it's kind of more than public relations moments when your CEOs are being hauled to speak to world leaders in multiple countries around the world under, you know, under some level of duress. The real threat to sort of existential threat to the business model of platforms is part of why I think platforms need to and have chosen to pay attention to some of this stuff. And hopefully that can be a force of good if the public is like, hey, platforms, please pay attention. Hopefully that actually spurs platforms to do more and to do better. But, you know, it's always a challenging thing to figure out not only how to do it, but also how to language it. And I'll let Katie talk more to some of those.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different angles that we had in the deck for people to kind of think about as they're thinking about the types of both harms, but also the positive things that this work can bring to society, because we really want to make sure that this isn't just focused on the negative stuff, but also some of the amplifying some of the positive. And first and foremost, Glenn mentioned there's compliance laws. There's actual rules and regulation that are already on the books. Political advertising is a great example of one. Here in the US, you could be, if you give help to one campaign over the other, it could be considered an in-kind donation and things of that nature that you need to be thinking about. There's legal liability. So just here this past weekend with the Turkish election, there's a lot of attention on how Twitter complied with a request from the government because content violated local law. Meta actually had to comply with that too. And so each of them, well, I know Meta geo-blocked it just to Turkey. I think Twitter did the same if they can, although they have different location abilities. But that's a great example of like one of these really hard trade-offs that companies will have to face, because if they had fought back on that request, there's a decent chance they would have been shut down completely in the country. And so that's one where it's like the company's like, I don't like either of these options, but I have to pick one.
What are those two options again?
The two options would be, so you either comply with the request and you don't make the content available inside that country. Some platforms like Meta can then say, but if you're outside of Turkey, you can still see it. But if you're inside Turkey, you can't. They do the same thing for Germany and Holocaust denial, where that's illegal inside Germany, but it's not necessarily illegal in other places around the world.
How are you approaching that policy decision?
Well, what you're weighing is, okay, do we comply with this request? And then you have to weigh the threat of how likely is it if you were, so there's first looking at the request. Did it come through the proper channels that you've set up? Like, is it actually in violation of local law? What are your options in terms of appealing it? Things of that nature. Like, you really have to kind of take, there's going to be a multi-step process you're going to do even just with the request itself. And your bigger companies are going to have your legal teams and everyone and government affairs teams and others are going to have a process for analyzing that. Then the question becomes, in some places, if you're okay with complying with it and you feel like that's the right thing to do, you might just go ahead and do it. Others then are going to maybe be weighing, okay, if we push back on this, what's the likelihood that they might shut our platform down completely in that country and not allow access to it? And so how do you balance that trade-off of like, okay, limiting the speech of one person or a group of people so you can stay up so the platform can be used by everybody else? Or do you risk it being shut down completely and nobody gets to use it? And especially if you look at those in countries where all the rest of the media and everything is government owned or controlled, like you really have to do these assessments by every individual country and what the situation is on the ground. And both Twitter and Meta made the decision of complying with the local law versus being completely shut down, which is where most of them have been when these debates come up, have generally been erring on the side of.
I mean, gotcha. It's really a pragmatism versus idealism question, right? And these are very real questions as you look at global things, because we don't all have the same ideals globally. We don't all internalize and operationalize in the same way. And then the question becomes, what can you live with and what should you live with to be able to, well, partly to make money, but also to have a platform that you feel is doing good in the world. And there's a bunch of countries where these platforms do get turned off during crisis moments and crisis periods, including elections, because there are people in power of internet in having control of the internet infrastructure who don't want that open discussion. And there's plenty of places where global platforms, can I say Western global platforms, are generally just permanently non-welcome, right? Like, so there's both the temporary and the permanent questions about, you know, what do you have to do to be in the market and can and should you do it?
And then on top of that, you have reputational risks that Glenn was mentioning. And so whether that's the media, civil society, others who are correctly playing an oversight role in the role that these companies have, but also can shine a spotlight on things. And, you know, they may only have, they usually only have a very small sliver into everything that the company is thinking and dealing with when it comes to elections. But the minute that spotlight goes on to that topic, you usually have to pull people off of other things, even if you try not to do it off of something you think is more important, but you just can't ignore the fact that this is something people are talking about and you need to address it. And that could even lead to, again, Tal, you were talking about these CEOs being dragged in front of world leaders, in front of Congress, you know, being called into the White House or something like that, of people wanting answers of what it is that you are or are not doing. And that can impact how your users feel about your platform, about how you're handling this, what they can trust, what they can't trust, et cetera. And then there's also, and these arguably I would say are probably the most important, but there's the direct on-platform harm, harassment of people, harassment of candidates, something we call brigading, which is, you know, just constant posting in the comment section in an organized fashion. Accounts can be compromised. There can be foreign interference. There's all sorts of direct platform harm that can happen no matter what type of company you are. And so one of the things we try to do with this guide as well is like not just be like, here's a bunch of Meta people telling you how you should do your job, or here's a bunch of Twitter people, but also trying to help people think about, okay, depending upon the platform you have, how do you put together, what's frameworks that you can use to really customize this to the type of platform you have and thinking about the risks you have. And then there's off-platform harm. And these two do intersect. And I don't think any of us have found exact right language to talk about on-platform, off-platform. There's like times where we're like real life and online life. We're like, everything's real life. So like, how do you think about talking about those types of things? But you know, what people see online, we have seen, turns into actual offline violence. And so how do you try to determine where that tipping point is and where that might be happening? I'll give you an example. If somebody is protesting and they say, let's protest to protect our democracy, it really depends and is different than if that's the Proud Boys saying that or potentially another organization that is just exercising in the United States their right to gather and protest. And a lot of organizations have that. It's like, when do you actually determine what they're saying is actually going to turn violent in real life and how you make those decisions? And that's where you get into some real minority report stuff that like can really take a lot of time of people trying to think about. And everybody has different lines when they're kind of really, they're willing to like cut things off out of concern that where things might go, et cetera. And then there's just the overall impact that this, what's happening on these platforms has on the overall societal trust in institutions, cohesion, polarization. The research in academia out there is incredibly varied still on what the actual impact, we know there's impact. It's just very hard still to quantify what exactly that impact is and what that does or does not look like. And so this is what makes it, you know, and one of the things that we recommend and what we also did, forgive me for saying it at Meta, is usually to start about a year and a half, 2 years out from an election to be able to have time to actually do these types of risk assessments, be talking to people on the ground, doing the type of research, making sure teams like Glenn had actual time to build these tools, because these are not, you don't flip a switch and you're like, look at us, we have political ad transparency. Look at us, we have this classifier that can find all this bad content. Like those things don't happen. To hire people in the right languages and backgrounds takes time. And so, especially if it's your first time doing it, it's a lot of work. You start to build things that you can replicate over and over and over again. And so Glenn, when he came in May of 2019, we still had a lot to learn, but we had been through a handful of elections throughout 2018 and testing grounds of building out those tools and doing, you asked about postmortems. we oftentimes did do postmortems of understanding what worked well, what didn't work well, what tweaks do we need to make, et cetera, and thinking about that. And then on the positive side too, is the company giving us the resources in which to do that and being able to think about that and build that up so that we could try as much as possible to make sure that we weren't burning people out. Because let me tell you, there's always an election happening somewhere in this world.
Thank you for that. And Glenn, I really want to know how your team was taking the problems that Katie mentioned and prioritizing what problems you're going to work on. You join May 2019, you see 2020 elections coming. You don't even know that COVID is going to happen and how that's going to change. How are you prioritizing in May 2019 what your team is doing? What products are you thinking about? And how are you building these core capabilities while also working on these ad hoc requests that come in whenever there is some international or even national escalation?
Totally. And, it is really interesting. And because you never have enough resources, I'd like to say this is an integrity problem, but it's an everything problem, right? In every business, especially a growing business, there's never enough time and people and energy to do all the things you want to do. You do have to spend a lot of time prioritizing. But in addition to prioritizing, the other thing you have to do is you have to figure out how to do what you're doing reasonably well, which is where I think what Katie was highlighting is, you do it once, you can learn it and replicate it maybe some to the futures. But fundamentally, you just have to plan ahead to figure out where your risks are and what you're going to invest in and how you're going to make those investments make sense. And I don't want to make this about efficiency because I don't really think it is. I think it's much more, you start with like red teaming and like sort of what are the threats and sort of open things and then prioritizing like what can we absolutely not live with, not dealing with. So it's a lot of must-dos. And then you figure out like, even in a company as far along in its process and as big as a company as Meta, there was a fair amount of throwing some things at the wall. And we created some space to say like, all right, we already have some things to deal with like harassment of online people. And then we said, but how does that actually work out in political contexts? And we spun up a team to specifically look at harassment in political context and how that might be different from general harassment and whether we need to do other or additional things to mitigate the risks, in this space. And, sometimes we spin those things up. We try some things. We come up with a few patches and then we move on to the next. Or we even try a few patches and discover they don't help and roll them back. Like there's a lot of experimentation and that sort of thing. And every platform is different and every problem is going to be different. But at a high level, what you really want to do is figure out, what are the risks that are out there so that you're not surprised with them in the moment. And when you get to the moment, you've accomplished two things. Number one, you've thought ahead far enough ahead to figure out that's a thing, and maybe to write up ahead of time what you would like to do about it and what your options are. So you're not sitting there on the night of the election going, oh my God, the winner's not clear. What do we do now? Because you thought about that and you think, okay, well, if it takes some time, what are we going to do during that time period when an election is not yet called? And then the second thing you do is you have that opportunity, as Katie alluded to actually build some tools and some options, right? So that when something happens, not only have you thought about like operationally who's dealing with it, but also what are the options you can give those people to operationally deal with it? And like, if you're scrambling your software engineers to build a thing to deal with a bad piece of content, 2 days before the election, that's a problem, right? You should have done two things. You should have had a way to figure out when you have a problematic piece of content on your platform, what your options are to do with it. And you should have a team set up that are not software engineers, because that was about the worst people in the world to be making a call on whether a piece of content should stay up or not, right? You've got a process to actually answer that question. And the people who answer that question have a clear path to a tool that they can go to and cause an action to happen. And that allows everybody to have their piece of the puzzle and allows them just a function, right? You've got processes operationally so that you can get through it. And I think that's pretty essential. And that's what I think, by several elections in, Meta was getting decent at. And then, I said at the top, this wasn't really about efficiency. It was more about like risk mitigation. And if you're still keeping a lot of this in a risk mitigation mindset, then really you've got the opportunity to make some investments, to try some things out, to try and reduce risks ahead of time. So it's not just do I have a tool to pull when there's a bad piece of content that goes viral in the middle of an election period? Maybe it's a piece of false content telling people that you can't go to the polls because there's been a, you know, a huge wave of violence at the polls and it's not safe to go, right? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. You have to figure, like, do you have a process to figure out whether that's true in the moment and deal with it fast enough to matter? But like, if it was false, would you have a way to take it down? Like, that's all very well and good. But I think a lot of risk mitigation is not actually about content moderation. It's not about a specific piece of content decision. It's really about having the context to know what kinds of things could present issues and then how those issues are going to flow through your platform. So for example, you know, is your platform super viral? Do things move really fast on your platform? If they do, that's probably going to make it a lot harder to do any content moderation based strategies where you got to like react to a piece of content fast enough to get a decision and then decide to take it up or take it down, you know, before everybody in the world has seen it or everybody in the country has seen it, right? And so like, are there things that you should do to try and reduce the risk proactively so you have fewer of those emergency moments? And this is where some of the work that's gone on around decisions made ahead of time about like, what is your platform going to do about paid political content? Like our classic examples that a number of platforms have thought of and have come to different decisions on, but they thought about like, hey, maybe I should try not to be taking money to circulate things in a time frame where I can't fact check it. And that cuts both ways, but it's a decision partly that is a risk mitigation decision. And by making those decisions ahead of time, you might be able to save your team to do other things during the crisis moments.
So what I'm hearing a lot right now is like a year out, you're thinking about what tooling to build to empower the right stakeholders to be able to make the right decisions content moderation wise. And what I'm also hearing is to also build these processes out such that when election night comes, you're not in a firefighting mode. So I wanted to really hone in on is what you were thinking in terms of red teaming. What things did he throw at the wall? What didn't work? And also, I'm just curious, how is political harassment different, right? My question here is, does political harassment work for the candidates? Do they want to get politically harassed? They get more viral. They get more attention. And in 2016, we saw attention is king, right?
I don't know, man. That no bad publicity, all publicity is good publicity thing. I don't know if I still agree with that, even after having watched certain recent elections and controversial personalities, right? The other thing I think is it's really a question less of like, do you want to create controversy and stir it up? Clearly, some people do want that and seek that out and use it as part of their brand. It's more a case of, is it right that the voices that get heard are only those who want that or and can stomach that and can deal with that versus people who are potentially shut out of the discussions for that? So like, I grew up in a little teeny town in Vermont and we had a town meeting, literally like everybody comes to the school and we sit there and we debate about the, you know, the budget for the next year, right? And, you know, people could be a little hostile to each other or whatever. And you know, but there was maybe some pushback against that. But like, imagine that imagine if somebody gets a little organized ahead of the town meeting and anybody who stands up and speaks in favor of, let's say, educational funding, they got 20 people ready and they just go and they stand up and they move and they surround that person. So that person can't even be seen while they're trying to speak. Right. Or imagine that they bring some boom boxes and they just play the loud music as soon as you know, somebody who's not on their side begins to speak. Right. Like that has an impact on that meeting and on the discussion. Right. And, you know, there's many ways that can go. One is that the people who are silenced, maybe they're silenced and they just can't. And they leave. Maybe it turns into a fist fight. I don't know. And I don't know which of those or both has been happening in the United States. I would argue some of both has been happening in the United States, as you've seen, you know, some parties really get aggressive about brigading type of harassment, organized mass harassment for a specific political agenda. And so I'm not saying people shouldn't be able to express their views. The question becomes, if you have a platform that is very open, which sounds fantastic, but that means that a lot of people can land on one person. And sometimes somebody does something, maybe they deserve a little bit of landing on, right? We've all seen people do some things where you really want to speak against them. You know, you stand up in the middle of the room and say, I'm a Nazi and blah, 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 blah. You'd like to have people speak against that. But there's all these questions of what is speaking against and then what is silencing and what is the discussion context that you are willing to have on your platform? And so political harassment as its own thing was basically, if people are pretty clearly using these tools to pursue an agenda and specifically to reduce voice, to prevent other people from being heard, as opposed to generate an engaging discussion around a topic of interest, you know, how can you do something useful about that? And when should
And I just want to add in the National Democratic Institute's done a lot of work on, usually a lot of times for political harassment, it is also disproportionately affecting female candidates and minority candidates as well. Where, and you know, we saw this too with election officials here in the United States and other places about the harassment they were facing, their addresses being put online, people being encouraging the death threats that they got. Some people had to move away from their homes because of what was happening. We had Facebook employees who were doxxed, or even something called swatted, where somebody calls in a fake report and a SWAT team shows up to your house thinking that something terrible is happening in all of this. And so these have some very real, it can feel like because it happens online that maybe it's not as bad as real life, but it is very much like what Glenn described, kind of like thinking about what's happening there in the room. And then there's the balance of giving people the tools to manage that, but then you're asking them to manage their own harassment that is happening to mm-hmm. them. And that too can be very traumatizing. But then when you balance that, if they are a candidate for office, like what they can or cannot delete. And in fact, there's a Supreme Court case now that the court agreed a couple of weeks ago to hear about whether or not government officials and candidates should even be allowed to remove people or block them from commenting on their sites, which is going to be a huge Supreme Court case to pay attention to. They'll hear arguments this fall, and then they haven't set the dates yet for that. But like, these are the types of things. And we keep getting into all this like really difficult nuance, which again, just sort of shows how complicated of an issue this can be and can get really quickly. And that's where the red teaming, Todd, like you're talking about, can really come in handy, because it gives you that chance to sort of step back, and you have people play a lot of these different characters. I can tell you, I play a very good political consultant who will do anything to help their candidate win. But that's the type of thing you want some of these folks to play, so that you're not making some of these decisions in the heat of the moment when it's actually happening. But you also have to recognize there's always going to be known unknowns, meaning you just aren't quite sure the exact flavor and situation you're going to be in, how it might manifest itself, that you need to have the processes in place for, like Glenn was saying, how do you actually handle it? And I think one of the challenges that's society as a whole and these companies have is that you can have quality, speed, or transparency, but you can't have all three right away. And so there's oftentimes a lot of things that you're seeing that you're like, oh, that looks bad. I don't think we want that on the platform. Shoot, but we don't have a policy that we can point to that specifically says why that bad thing can't be done. And so the company oftentimes is going to make a call to be like, I'm just going to take that down. And then later on, you know, the oversight board might be like, well, you should be more transparent for people about why that's happening. We're like, we agree with you, but we're still struggling with how we move quickly in being able to do that and trying to stop the harm of those things. And so, yeah, red teaming can just really help you to kind of think through those things and try to get ahead of them.
Otherwise, you're Elon Musk, you know, and you're going through the there's a thing. Oh, sorry. There's not a thing. Wait, I'm relaunching the thing. Or but not these people. But those people. But a thing. Oh shit. Right. You know. I mean, really, this is where structuring and thinking ahead really saves your bacon, and being able to be defensible and consistent in what you're doing. I don't know. Maybe fair to say that requires some amount of staff, which may be part of where Twitter's having some trouble these days. But you know, you really want to figure out these things ahead of time. The other thing If you'll forgive a quick aside, as Katie was talking about like the doxing of election workers and things, I thought that was a crystalline example of the difference between impact to your users and impact to people and society beyond your users, right? Like if you're online and you are getting punished, you know, that is an impact to your user and you're going to potentially lose those users and their voice and that sort of stuff. But imagine these election workers may not even be on Facebook or on Twitter or on whatever it is. But if they're if something's organizing on the platform that's doxing those people and calling them all the worst things in the world and causing them to leave their homes, then pretty soon you have no election workers, right? Or the only election workers you have are the ones who are in cahoots with the people who forced out the other ones. And then how do you run a free and fair election? So that's an example of how the harms can really spill beyond the users of your platform. And it's not necessarily sufficient to just make sure everybody sees things that they are okay seeing. It's also, you have to think about the people who are maybe even not on your platform, but are threatened by the actions on your platform.
So what I'm hearing a lot from both of you is to be comprehensive in the state, the different stakeholders that these processes affect. I guess like one concrete example of this was the January 6th insurrection, right? They were just like, take it down. We'll come up with a policy in like, I don't know, when it was in 2-3 weeks that Trump is banned from the platform for X amount of years. And this is how his account can be reinstated. I kind of want to zoom out to the world. I think, Katie, you mentioned Turkey and Facebook and Twitter taking action to regulate their platform there. So I guess my question is one is how are U.S. elections different between other world elections and what makes the U.S. so exceptional? And then on top of that, Glenn, you mentioned not just users being affected by the governance of the platform, but also everyone in that jurisdiction. So how are you, one, keeping in mind that you have so many fires and so many elections around the world and the people affected aren't just users of the platform?
Yeah, so I can start because this is my favorite topic to talk about, which is the number of elections happening in 2024. So part of the reason we wanted to get this out now, and frankly, I think we would have loved to have done it sooner, but there was just, as you can hear, so much content for us to try to think about, is that in 2024, it's going to be the first time ever in the world that in the same year, you're going to have not just a U.S. presidential election, but elections in India, Indonesia, Ukraine, Taiwan, Mexico, the United Kingdom, the European Parliament, and overall 65 elections across 54 countries. This is massive. This is a massive number of fronts in which to be thinking about these issues. A vast majority of those elections, those big ones that I mentioned, will happen in the spring of 2024, which is when the U.S. primaries will be happening. A big mistake would be to think like U.S. election, it's just November. No, the primaries start in January. And in fact, debates are going to start here in the summer in August. And Donald Trump just did a town hall last week. So like it started, like it's here and it's happening as you're doing all of this. And so companies need to be thinking about this now as we do this. And to your point, Taha, I wouldn't say that U.S. elections are exceptional, but they are an exception in terms of how they operate versus the rest of the world. And we have a chart for this in the guide, but the U.S., rather than having one, even though we have the Federal Elections Commission, they are not the one that actually manages elections in the United States. It's actually state and local and county level election officials that do so. So it's a much more decentralized process, which can both bring to its positives and negatives of how that works. The U.S. has the most amount of money that is spent in these elections. It also has the existence of things like super PACs and other outside groups that tend to operate in these elections. Our also view of the First Amendment and how political speech is protected is amongst, I think, probably the strongest of how much it is protected versus how other countries might think about that. Other countries oftentimes have a single election commission that is managing that election across that entire country, which makes it a lot easier for coordinating when you're a company and wanting to do that. Many times their election periods are shorter, so it might just be 6 weeks when they're officially campaigning or not. there's different formats. So there's the parliamentary system where you're voting for a party. You're not voting necessarily for a candidate. There's all sorts of different ones that you have to think about. Most countries outside of the United States also have what are called blackout periods. So this could be in France, it's 6 months long. Most countries, it's 72 to 48 hours or 24 hours long, where the candidates can't campaign, the news orgs can't talk about polls or anything. It's just a complete silence period of people talking about politics before they go to vote. A place like India, actually, the voting period is 2 months long because different parts of different states are going to the polls at different times. And so you don't actually know. And also in many countries, you don't have the drip, drip, drip of results like you do in the states. Like usually it's you have the election and then all of it gets tallied and election commission is like, here's the final winner, here's the final loser. Or you're starting to see a little bit more of that, of seeing some of the results, but it's just not the same as in the US. And so it would be a real detriment to people to not realize that going in and thinking like whatever country you come from, that is going to be the same in how it works elsewhere around the world, which adds the complexity of trying to think about how you're going to handle all these things.
I'll just give a quick perspective as somebody who came in really thinking US context and came into a global context at Meta. And you know, so it's kind of interesting, right? Because I was working at a US-based company where headquarters for the United States, most of the people working for Meta were in the United States at the time of full-time employees and or, you know, had a lot of cultural context shared that way. But 90% of Meta's users were outside the US. 90%. Right. And so, yeah, taking and generalizing from the US context to other contexts and other countries is dangerous, both because the United States is perhaps more of an oddball amongst all the oddballs of how different countries run themselves. So maybe it's a particularly odd sample to go from. But, you know, wherever you are based and whatever your deep learning is, every country is different. Right. And so take hypothetically that, you know, the next Twitter comes out of Indonesia, let's say. Right. Country almost as big as the United States, right? So then, you know, everybody who's working at that platform, everybody in the integrity team or 70% of the integrity team or something is Indonesian. How is that team gonna have the context and understand a weirdness like structural things in the US where we have all these local election commissions? They're gonna be like, what the hell is that, right? Or even just a broader political context, how would that company deal with discussions and deep understanding of the context of discussions of race in America, our civil war, our political leaders from George Washington up through, you know, JFK, right? What the First Amendment, the Second Amendment means here, right? That's all gonna be alien to most of the staff. So really, you really have to think, if you have a platform that gets used in places that are not where you and your staff are, you know, how do you take some steps to maybe try and get some local knowledge? Can you go and engage with civil organizations? Can you have some people like literally just bring in some context and share it with your team? Can you bring people into your team? And then know what you can't do, which is that, you know, Meta's not going to all be staffed with Indonesians. TikTok's not going to be entirely staffed with Americans. So please, you know, think about how you do no harm. Think about how you can remain disciplined and not trip over, you know, cultural things that you're not going to have full understanding of as you're trying to operate in that area.
We heard some interesting maxims throughout this episode. How are you going to, one, do no harm, and how you want to maximize speech? What are other maxims? I guess that's kind of reductive, is I don't want to reduce your work to a few maxims, right? But how can people that are at a startup per se, let's say a 5-person startup, right? How are these people going to even prioritize elections, right? Because this 5-person startup, this one person's probably doing all the partnerships, doing all the media, even like doing any of the other integrity work. How does elections even come into their mind? How do they even map out the landscape of what this looks like?
I'll say one thing and then pass to Katie, because again, this is really more her ball. But, you know, Tala, you called out whether we're sort of throwing maxims out there. I think if you rename them to principles and say that it's really important to be principled in these moments, right? Because elections, we've already said, they're kind of a stress test for your elections. They're really important to people. They have super high levels of real world consequence. So these are situations where, as an integrity worker, you want to understand the principles at stake You want to acknowledge that they're all going to compete with each other, but still try and figure out how to be reasonably principled about your decision-making from the planning stages through to the in the trenches operational stuff. But I'll let Katie speak more.
So, sorry. I just want to say, like, what are the principles that you're thinking, Glenn?
I mean, okay. So like at a high level, you want to try and make sure you're being reasonably fair. You want to be open. You want to promote speech and politics and democracy. I think most of the platforms, certainly any platform I would work at, would be an expressly pro-democracy platform. You want to acknowledge that no democracy, including the one in the United States, is perfect. But you want to make sure that your platform is not uniquely causing harm and that your integrity work is minimizing the harms that can come from your platform and maximizing at the same time the opportunities for people to actually engage in political discourse. I mean, so that's what it boils down to me. It's just trying to promote discourse, avoid creating new harms, and minimize the harms that your platform may be somehow involved in that reduce democracy.
Katie, you were saying?
Yeah, I want to put it more in newer platforms versus smaller. And I made that shift recently because you have some platforms like TikTok that have a high number of users, but I can reasonably argue that 2024 is going to be the first presidential level election that they're really going to have the spotlight on them that they have to focus on. And while they're doing a lot around elections, they haven't been at this as long as Meta has. I mean, TikTok was what, a year and a half old when 2016 happened. Like, so it's newer platforms that are having to build this, and they come at it through a couple of different ways. Some are a bit more proactive. Some realize that it's only a matter of time before the spotlight turns on us, and so we want to be ready. But a lot of them end up having to do this when that spotlight finally turns on them. You know, that could be Discord was already doing some work in this space, but, you know, recently they had those classified materials that showed up on the Discord server that they may have been hoping wouldn't have happened and they wouldn't have to deal with, but it did. I find others who are just like, we're just going to ban politics, but you still have to make the decision of what is political. What is or is not going to be, that in itself is a political decision. Like, that is not necessarily any easier than doing any of this. And so eventually this bill comes due where you need to actually be thinking about it. And so a couple of things we fully recognize that, and this was really feedback we got from members where they were like, guys, this is great, but like it's half of one person's time. Like, I don't even know. Like, it's a bit of overwhelming. And so we really wanted this to be comprehensive so that it fit. And it was a bit of a thing that you could treat as a menu of like, okay, where are there things I can grab and pull? And we try to help them prioritize and help them to think about how they might prioritize. So first and foremost, it's just mapping out the ways your platform can be used for politics, mapping out the different types of harms and other things that might happen. We give some suggestions around external organizations that you might talk to that can help you to think about this, civil society groups on the ground, expert networks, other things that exist for you to be able to do this. This is why we're doing this as the Integrity Institute. We're hoping that we can provide some of these tools for folks. There's a lot of data sets out there that people can already grab from that are open source to be able to think about a lot about this. We have them map the countries that they're available in. So, and where your user base is, because that should be a big thing of thinking about too, of where you might need to be doing work versus not. Nobody likes to talk about the fact that we have to prioritize which countries' elections we work on, but the fact of the matter is that you have to, and you have to think about that. And we try to give some guidance of how you might actually do that.
So how are you thinking about that?
Oh gosh, that could be a whole other podcast of thinking about that. But we really recommend there's different criteria you kind of think about, how many users you have in the country, past history of violence offline, past history of foreign interference, past history of what's happened online. And there's a data site from the organization Varieties of Democracies that has a lot of this. We also recommend a lot of people start with Freedom House. That's an organization based here in DC. DC that puts out an annual report of whether or not a country's elections are free, partly free, or not free. And that can oftentimes be a very good beginning starting point for helping platforms to understand how you might prioritize this or what the different risks might be in terms of thinking about this. But like that is going to be a decent, you know, can be a decent part of the work that you kind of think about doing this.
So just to hone in on that, 2018, you did it, right? There was Brazil and the U.S.
There were a bunch of other ones too, but because we were doing election day reminders in every country. I mean, I started building those by myself in 2014. It wasn't until the Civic Integrity team was hired in 2015 where I could stop playing engineer and doing that. And so even though I was mentioning US and Brazil, there were a bunch of elections that we were, you know, doing. We called it sort of a minimally viable program instead of a minimally viable product of what we could do. You know, we already had an operations team that had a lot of language capability and other things that we were working on. There was partnerships we could do with people on the ground around media literacy and things of that nature to help people know where and when and how to vote. And so while we may have only been doing some initially some of the most sophisticated tools in some of the bigger elections over time, like political issue at transparency. 2018, we launched it to US and Brazil, but then we very rapidly launched it for 2019 elections. And then eventually it got launched to voluntarily to all countries. And now I think it's enforced in a vast majority of countries around the world. That just took time to build out and to do and to kind of think about that in terms of, and just the realistic like reality that we couldn't turn it on and have good enforcement everywhere around the world right away. And you had to make some of those decisions. And that a lot too would depend upon when that country's elections were coming up, what laws they had into place, et cetera, in trying to do some of that.
So what principles were at play there when you were deciding which countries to prioritize? This might be too in the weeds, but yeah, let's go for it.
Well, there's also different teams at different country prioritization. The political and ad, this is mostly Meta, so forgive people. It might have been different at other companies. So I don't want to say this is just my experience from there. But so the political and issue ad stuff was being built by a different product team than necessarily the team Glenn was on and the types of tooling and stuff that they were building. And then we also had my policy team and folks that might do trainings and others. And the capacity of each of these teams is different at different times. And so that's where my team, one of the things we try to do in terms of that coordination was I oftentimes played an internal political consultant to a lot of these teams because they pull me in and they're like, hey, Katie, okay, here's what we think we have capacity for over the next year, next 6 months of doing. What would you recommend? What countries would you recommend we prioritize based upon? Oftentimes, I was very much looking at schedule. I was looking at size of the election. I was looking at if they even allow online political advertising, because some countries don't, and what the rules might be for that. We were looking at if there is existing regulation or pending regulation around that and what that might look like. That was specifically for political ads. I know for the Civic Integrity team, there was additional things around, again, potential of violence, past histories of foreign interference, different things of that nature that needed to be taken into account. And then we did the best that we could to try to come up with a score. And then rank those countries depending upon what that was, because we wanted to try to have something as defensible as possible about why we came up with the decisions that we did. And I want to really emphasize too, like I said, even though like a country like India and Indonesia may have been getting the gold or the platinum version, like the best thing that we could do, that didn't mean everybody else was getting nothing. Like we were doing stuff in those other countries as well. And like there were some, people can't see this, but I'm going to say Russia's elections in quotes. Russia, ironically, does not allow foreign companies to interfere with their elections. So we couldn't even do the election day reminders in Russia because it was likely going to be, this is obviously before the Ukraine war happened and everything with that. And so it was very rare that we do absolutely nothing in a country. But so those were the types of things. And so then we'd look at the list of everything we could do, what everyone's capacity was. And that was a process that that was sort of really ongoing, but then really did it like every 6 months, like really took a fresh look at it to make sure that everybody sort of knew what the roadmap was going to be, not just for the next 6 months, but like for my team, again, we were looking 18, 24 months ahead and trying to figure out like what steps we needed to start taking.
Actually, you mentioned a really salient point there with the refreshing every 6 months that lines up with obviously with Meta's performance cycle at the time was every 6 months. So Glenn, I wanted to ask you regarding every 6 months here, how are you defining what an engineer's performance looks like for those every 6 months, especially when you have like a longer term view on these items? I'm assuming maybe it's easier in the civic integrity team where you're building up to an event that's coming in 2 years, but how are you balancing Meta's persistence on a 6 month impact cycle versus elections that happen perhaps every 2 years, or maybe elections happen every 6 months somewhere in the world. So you can always prioritize that.
Thank you. I think Meta's, first of all, let's not go too deep into the particulars of how Meta does employee evaluations. They're a little odd. I will say that structurally, you know, if you have an implementation team of any type, that what you want to do is you want people to be able to be productive. And you want people, therefore, to be generating impactful, productive work on a consistent basis, right? And obviously, you may have a moment in time where you got a particularly big lever you're pulling, and then another point, you got a slightly smaller lever that you're pulling. So sometimes you're multiplying by a bigger or a smaller number. But what you want to do fundamentally are two things. Number one is set people up for success, where they have an environment where they can be productive. You have the tools, you're building things far enough ahead that you can do things that replicate and scale. Right, as individuals, that they're freaking just rested enough, right? And so, like, you know, you make an elections program so you figure out, do we have people, do we know who's going to be dealing with stuff during critical moments like voting periods, and can we set up like a rotation so that people who are going to be up overnight while votes are being tabulated someplace have had a couple days off before that, and they get a couple days off after that, right? Like there's things you can do to just care for your people in terms of giving them decent tools, giving them a structure that allows them to work. And then the other thing you do is you just want to make sure that you have enough context that what you're doing can be successful and can be working on real problems, right? Like we said, there's elections happening somewhere all the time. Does that mean you always need to be sending an election reminder? Maybe that's a good impactful work. Maybe you can get good enough at it that that's like a really small amount of incremental work to send the next one. And then that allows you to clear your head to say what, you know, whether a half of a human in the whole company, or whether we're a team of 10 dealing with misinformation or whatever it may be, like, do you understand your problem well enough that the work that your team is doing is high priority work consistently? And if that's the case, then you're going to have a group of happy, relatively sane, despite the emotional costs of working in politics and elections all the time, team that I'm sure will be building good things.
And I think I just want to add as well, like, you know, when I started all this work at Facebook, it was like three of us that were doing, like, that's back in the 2012, 2013 timeframe. So I remember distinctly what it felt like to be like, and it obviously it was different back then. We weren't paying attention to the harms in the way that we are now, which is good that we are doing it earlier now. But I also think it would be a big mistake for those like watching these companies, asking these questions, to just assume that all of these companies have the resources that the Facebooks, the Googles, and others have in which to build this. Like, it'd be very wrong to assume that you can build this overnight. Like, it took years to build up Meta's program. It took Google years to build up its program. And so that's why I'm saying I kind of use the phrase newer companies now versus just the size of how they do that, because the reality is that you are going to have to make some tough choices as you try to continue to build this out. And that's one of the things we say in here is about being realistic about what's possible. And I think that's one of the things that at least I know I will be talking a lot about as I go into 24 is trying to manage expectations. I was just having a conversation with somebody before this podcast and they were like, I think Google's even thinking about how AI is going to impact politics. And I go, of course they are. It's just, we can't expect them to be like, all this stuff happened. Oh, here's this big book of new policies that we're going to have about how it's going to affect every single thing. Those things, if you want them to be done thoughtfully, those things take time in which to do. And unfortunately, time is usually our worst enemy when it comes to working in the election space, because as much as I try to find a tool to pause all elections until we can get our stuff together, I have not yet found that superpower.
Working to external dates, that's always fun. Adds an extra little frisson of excitement to the work that you're doing. I've done it a lot of times, and I'm a startup person at heart. So, you know, this idea that like, you got to do what you got to do to survive. Like, and you might wish you could do a lot more of it, but you can't. Like, that's just life. But figuring out what you can do to survive and going back to like, what does that mean success looks like? It means, what do you need to do? How do you do it in the minimal way that you can do it? Do it in a way that scales so that you don't have to redo it next time, or when you redo it next time, it's easier. But you're just building, and building takes time. Building is incremental. But this is what you got to do, because these things matter and have big impact.
Yeah, for sure. Katie, you mentioned that Google is definitely thinking about how AI will affect their elections. How are you thinking about this? I can think of 5 billion things, right? There is that RNC deepfake Biden ad. I'm assuming there's going to be like a little slightly more innocuous things where your political spam email is now going to be AI generated instead. So that's probably another thing. And then on top of that, add in Twitter blue check marks being able to be bought. You can't even trust what a blue check mark is saying anymore. And especially if a blue check mark, I don't know, sends out another deep fake, then what's the sense of authority here? Actually, even take a step back, is there's a platform aspect to it, but now there's even like the AI companies themselves. So there's OpenAI might have to start thinking about political speech, right? Or any of these other chatbots. So one, from the platform side, how should they map this landscape out? And two, from the AI company side, how should they start approaching this problem and building programs and, I guess, even red teaming?
Yeah, so I have a feeling that AI politics are going to be the subject of a lot of future episodes of Trust in Tech. But I think that, so a couple of things I would just say. One, we really built this deck, and we really tried to approach this so that it can be a little bit of an evergreen thing. Like, no matter what type of online platform you might be, I think these frameworks and everything in here can be helpful as you start to think through this. Because while how the problems manifest on your platform might be different, the types of questions you have to ask yourself typically tend to be the same thing. And so I think that I already know these AI companies are trying to think about this. ChatGPT and OpenAI are actually one of the few that have a front-facing policy that talks about how their tools can be used for campaigning and politics. Others, I was playing around with some of the other tools the other day. And so like, if I typed in, write me a blog post about the importance of voting, I got blocked. And so it kind of depends each, but there's no outward policy yet that they're saying that they're allowing it or not allowing it. But there's clearly been thought internally about how to, at least in the beginning, about not allowing that until they kind of figure out more guardrails and stuff in which to put around that. I think that, so on one hand, like you mentioned, I think there's going to be a lot of positive uses of AI. I do think that, like, particularly the smaller campaigns that don't have the resources to build out all the different types of content you have to do these days, AI is going to be able to help you to do that. AI is going to be able to help you to think about better voter modeling, creating A/B tests for ads, generating like video and audio of your candidate and other things that you might, again, just not be able to do otherwise because you may not have the staffing and the resources. On the downsides, everybody's focused on the deep fakes right now. There is obviously the photo ones that you mentioned, video ones. I'm particularly concerned about audio because I think you have the least amount of context when it comes to audio when you hear that and what that looks like. But these things are very, very real. But we also need to remember that the tools that are used to generate these can also be the tools that are used to detect these. And so you have a lot of folks that are kind of dealing with that and what these companies are thinking about. A lot of these companies need to be thinking about how do we even allow politicians and governments to use it at all? There's going to be a congressional hearing. There's three hearings in Congress this week on AI. And one of those is about government use of AI and what that should look like. Because it can be really scary if you think about it in a surveillance context of how that might look like. But then if you're like, okay, some press secretary wants to use it to create various, so they don't have to write a separate Facebook post, Instagram post, Twitter post. Like there's so many different social medias these days that they might be using it. Like that seems a little less harmful. There's a lot of other ways that this is going to potentially manifest. And I think the only thing I've been telling people is that the only thing I can guarantee is that we are going to have tools that are created and used by the end of 2024 that we have not even dreamt up of today. And how our world is going to look, it's going to look so different by the end of next year than it does today. That one of the things in looking through and thinking about these processes is, yes, do the red teaming, find the gaps, think of every scenario you can of what you might do, but have a process in place for dealing with the known unknowns or even the unknown unknowns and how you're going to triage those and think about them, because it just creates, you're still going to be stressed. It's still going to be not great, but you at least will have a process to follow versus trying to make it up on the fly, where you're much more likely to make mistakes of how this might look like and may not be thinking about the unintended consequences that could come from some of the decisions that you are doing. And so I suspect that over the summer and over the last couple of months, there's been a lot of thinking and discussions inside. I don't know for sure. This is just an inkling about how these things should be handled. Then I wouldn't be surprised as we start going into the fall and early 2024 and throughout all of next year, we're going to be seeing a lot of policy updates and changes from companies and thinking about, do we label this content? Do we not label this content? Do we allow it? Do we not allow it? Do we allow amplification? Do we not? Like, these are all the things that they're going to be needing to think through as they do this. And unfortunately, a lot of that's going to be building the plane while it's flying, because these elections just keep coming.
So, Katie, how are you building these processes for unknown unknowns and unknown unknowns? So how should people think about them beforehand?
Yeah, I think the most important things to be thinking about is doing some type of red teaming. And it doesn't have to be an all day thing. Oftentimes we would just take an hour where people would quickly brainstorm different types of things. And then a team would take that back and sort of think about those types of things. This is also another area where you can engage external stakeholders and what those might be. But the most important thing is just think through, okay, make sure your company knows something comes in. Where are those? Is it going to be through your policy team, your press team? Like, where is it going to be your ops team that might see these? How do you triage these into a person or a team who's on call to see those? And then who are the people that need to be in the room to have the discussion, or who decides who needs to be in the room to have the discussion? Just do that simple mapping exercise. That alone is going to be so helpful when the thing actually breaks, that those people are going to know and will have met ahead of time, being like, all right, we're the team. We're the team that gets called when this happens. Kind of think about it like it's like the fire or public emergency, right? Like an ambulance is going to come. These folks are going to come when that happens. And you just know that you all are going to have to get together when that happens.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the secret to managing all these unknowns and things is just, it's red team, red team, red team. And the reason you red team is so that you can then work in an informed but creative way to deal with what's going to happen, right? It's, I mean, we have a best practices to share. So we have a deck to share, and it shows some things that people have done before. Some of those, you can take ideas from them and you can do them. But more than that, what we want to help you do is get to where you are in an informed way, able to be creatively addressing your problems, right? So the deck has some past practices. The deck also has some ways to find people who are like stakeholders in the field, maybe from civil service organizations, who can inform you about the context. The Institute itself is full of veterans who've done some of these things before. We can help you to understand what's been done, as well as what people are going to do next with AI or with whatever else is transforming our world. So hopefully the deck gives some clues, and the Institute as well, we can help you just find that way to be informed and then creatively address the safety of your platforms.
Appreciate that, Katie and Glenn. I read through the deck as well, and I learned it a lot, right? There's even more that we couldn't even get to, right? We couldn't get to how to scale an organization, the different types of organizational models that you guys have seen, centralization versus decentralization. So obviously everyone should read that deck. And how do people reach out to you, Katie and Glenn, to learn more about how to approach election best practices?
Definitely go to the Integrity Institute website, integrityinstitute.org. You can see there's a section for election integrity that you can click on. We'll have that deck there. We also have a dashboard looking at elections going all the way out to, I think, 2072. So we have a lot of different resources there. That's the best way. I'm also on LinkedIn. I've got a Substack newsletter called Anchor Change that you can find me talking about some of these issues. I'm on pretty much any social media of choice. So whatever their preference is to find me, that I'm probably there.
Reach out on the socials.
For sure. And final question, what are you guys thinking about nowadays, besides elections, I guess?
Whether the AIs are going to like keep us as pets or not.
Nice.
Yeah, I think that there's... you know, I talked about 2024 in terms of the elections around the world, but it's also just going to be a huge geopolitical moment. And I think a lot too about how all this is going to change diplomacy and trade talks and everything else like that. Like the EU and India are having conversations this week around this. Obviously, the US and EU have been trying to do that as well. And I think as we start to see more regulation get passed and where it contradicts itself, especially even here in the US between different states and Supreme Court rulings and stuff like that, it is going to require that we're going to have to find new ways in which of how to make all of this work, because these companies aren't going to be able to have different and manage different rules and different places. You know, the internet is a place without borders, trying to operate in a world with borders. And I think that's really challenging. And it's going to be a new diplomatic challenge for any country around the world.
Thanks for both of you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Dahl.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed today's conversation, please share this episode to your friends so we can continue making episodes like this. Today's episode was produced by me, Talha Baig. Music by Zhao Shen. And special thanks to Sahar, Cass, Rachel, and Sean for their continued support.